Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony. Thank you for tuning in to episode 201. And coming back to the show is friend of the show, the comic curator of Toronto himself, Mr. Kevin Boyd. Welcome back to the show. Hello. Kev.
Thanks for having me back.
It's a real treat to have you back, and you're kicking off the 200s. You're 201. So it's a new era.
Oh, really? All right. Yeah. I'm honored.
It's usually when a new artist or writer comes on, right? Issue 201. Mm. We start a new era of
that's right, of
the podcast.
We had the big anniversary special. Now it's time to forge ahead, right?
Right. Yep. Hopefully my 200th episode wasn't as bad as the Avengers 200, but mm-hmm. We'll let the audience decide. That's
well, we just found out Aunt May's still alive and it's Spider-Man 200, right? So
that's right.
Everyone thought she was dead for a while, so.
That's right.
So sometimes it's good news.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the last time we spoke, it was March, just before the March Comic-Con. We were very, very hopeful. We had a whole lineup ready to go. Very positive attitude amidst the pandemic that was announced. And everything just completely changed within a week.
The world has completely turned on its head since we last spoke.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And it's still changing day by day. You never know what's going to happen. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like if this is what it would feel like if we were living inside of a what-if issue of Marvel.
Yeah.
You know, what if the year started off with rainforest fires and people were talking about impending war, and then this pandemic, and now with all the civil unrest that you're seeing, it's like, it's not the year's not, it's just halfway through.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, God knows we still have the whole U.S. election to deal with later in the year, and that's going to turn that country on its head. It's already having an effect on things, but
yeah.
I mean, and they're saying the Canadian border is going to stay closed for who knows how long. They're saying it's going to right to June 21st, but they're going to extend it probably to end of July again. So who knows what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
No conventions at all. So definitely missing the conventions.
Yeah. How have things been for you? How have you been doing during this whole thing?
Well, I'm having an interesting summer of really doing nothing except watching television and reading. So, and sorting through stuff because with no cons, so we still have cons scheduled. So it's a question of, you know, we cancel a con, maybe we reschedule it, maybe we beef up something later in the year. Then that one gets canceled and then we have to do it to the next one. So it's like, I'm constantly checking in with creators just to say, hey, are you up for this if this happens or not? So that's sort of where I am right now. It's sort of like right now everyone's like, well, Fan Expo Canada is the next one on the list. Is it going to be canceled or not? So I've got the full guest list booked for the show, but we're not going to announce anything because chances are something's going to happen and it's either not going to happen or it's going to be drastically different than what we're used to. So like a lot of people may turn around and say, if we do go ahead, then they're not coming because they don't want to take that risk, right? And you have to respect that.
Yeah. When it comes to, like, I'm not sure what the new phase we're in or where they expect to be, but it seems as though they canceled the whole summer.
Pretty much, yeah.
Pretty much, right? And they said that up to gatherings of no more than 250. So would that automatically cancel out the Metro Toronto Convention Center?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, right now, we rely, because it's a provincial facility, they have to ultimately make the call of whether or not the show can go ahead or not. So we're kind of in limbo waiting until that comes through. So we have to assume that it is until it isn't. And because when it isn't, then that is a sort of a domino effect. You can go to your hotels, you can notify your guests that things aren't happening, you can refund tickets, all those things. You can't really do any of that until you know for sure that the facility is telling you you can't do it. And so I think the premier is saying no home gatherings of any more than 10 people as of this week. So 5 to 10. So a larger place, a larger facility, depends on the square footage. And I think 250 is the absolute maximum. So if you're looking at a place like a giant Costco or something like that, you know, no more than a couple hundred people at most in the store, and they have to monitor pretty severely how many people go in and how many people go out. So I would think if we were to go ahead, that would be some kind of a situation where the attendance is severely monitored, and you would get a time pass maybe to come in. I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I'm not saying that's what we're going to do, but it would have to be, you'd have to institute like things like temperature checks and stuff like that, that some of the Asian shows are reopening right now, places in Hong Kong and Tokyo and places, you know, Singapore, and they have thermometers at the doors. They check everybody's temperature, see if they're, you know, maybe they have a fever or something like that. And they also, everyone has to wear a mask. So that's going to be a given for most of the shows this year, is if anything happens, people will have to wear masks, I think, which isn't so bad if you're a stormtrooper, but
I was going to say for the rest cosplayers, hey, they're fine with that as is, right?
Yep.
You're going to see a lot of Spider-Man with a mask on top of a mask.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. Everyone's really missing the con. I think people desperately want to be able to have that sort of congregating of something to do that they love, right? You start to really go through the withdrawal after a couple months. You feel like, you know what, this is the best thing, it's good, but when the summer comes around and the sky is blue and the sun's shining, we all have that, oh man, I'm ready for doing this thing, and it's like, you can't.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any difference or anything to be said with all of the gatherings that have been going on with the protesting, if that's almost an experiment in itself to see how many people can gather together. And nothing, there isn't a extreme consequence of a lot of people getting sick or an outbreak. I don't know if that would make any sort of, I don't know, an argument to be made.
It's hard to say. I mean, the good thing is that most of them are outdoors, and outdoor events, there's less transmission.
That's true.
And what's good to see is that most people at the protests and assembling have masks on.
Yeah.
So they're doing their best to mitigate transmission of the disease. It's a risk with everything we do now. I mean, the good thing is I think the numbers are fairly small right now. There's still a chance they can always go up.
Yeah.
Which is the whole thing, right? So, you know, you could get it from going to the store as much as you could going to a protest. So, and the same thing, you know, or maybe our conventions are okay, but I think part of the problem is it's enclosed spaces with minimal air. You know, you look at a place like I used to work at the University Health Network, so the air is all filtered and circulated there. So that helps prevent transmission of airborne diseases as much as possible. And so I think an indoor facility like the Metro Convention Center might want to look into their air filtration methods and maybe find a way to push more fresh air in and more interior air out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But that could... an upgrade like that could cost millions.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, I mean, everyone has always kind of talked about that con crud that you get, or that sort of, people would typically be fighting a little bug after the con, because there is a lot of like touching, and you're going to, you know, all of these different retailers, and you're going through books, and you never know who was there before you. And so, yeah, sure, there's... cons may not be the best place to try things out, but we'll see.
Right.
We get to be seen.
Either that, or we've all built up in like great immunity from doing these shows for so long that eventually it's like, yeah, this con crud going around, but it doesn't last longer than a couple hours.
Yeah, that's true. I haven't actually gotten sick. Yeah, did you say that again?
I find it's the dust.
Yeah,
in particular.
Yeah, it's true. Well, here's hoping that we get something. And maybe we got to do an outdoor show of some kind where we can get together. I don't know. So
yeah, I mean, I used to enjoy going to the there was the book festival in September, and that was all outdoors for a long time. I don't know if it's still outdoors or if it's indoors now. But you set up tents, you know, you could do stuff. There are alternatives if this is a really long-term situation where we can't have indoor events, so.
Yeah.
You just have to worry about sunlight and rain, which are our biggest enemies for preserving comic books. So yeah.
I wonder what it's going to be like as well for, I mean, you travel to a lot of these shows, right? So do you have any trepidation of getting on airplanes and what the cost of that's going to be now with,
absolutely. You know? 100%. I have asthma. I'm overweight. I'm worried about my health as well and catching this and what it could do to me. And so I'm not sorry that some of the shows to some of the more high risk places that we had going, like Florida and Texas. I mean, it concerns me what I see in the news. I mean, the good thing is I think our next events in those areas are like October.
Yeah.
So hopefully things will calm down a little bit by then. And I don't even know if I'm going to those ones as well. So I usually just go to the big, top tier level event, and then just sort of manage my section remotely for the smaller shows.
Right.
Toronto Comic Con, I'm here obviously, but something like Dallas Fan Days or the new MegaCon Limited Edition, I don't know if they're going to send me or not, or if I'm just going to use my local coordinator to, be the man in the chair for.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Better safe than sorry, for sure. You don't want to take unnecessary risks because of, missing the things that we love. They'll come back around, and we got to make sure that we're healthy for them.
Fingers crossed for next year, right? So.
Yeah. Will there be any adjustment if we get like the Fan Days event happening in December? That looks like it's plausible. Will there be any thing to maybe make it a 2-day or extend that to make up for? Anything?
Well, that would be that's sort of up to management at this point.
Mm-hmm.
If for whatever reason Fan Expo Canada doesn't go forward, and I would say there's probably a good likelihood that it isn't, then I would also not be surprised if management said, let's do something bigger in the Christmas show. Maybe make it a 2-day event or do something a little bit more exciting. Again, it all depends on what's safe to do, what's not safe to do, and so forth. So we're using that model for the Orlando and Texas shows. We're beefing them up a bit for the fall ones, which are usually smaller events, but we're going to have more higher tier guests and so forth at those, in the hopes of making up for the loss of the top tier event.
Yeah.
So we'll see. It would be kind of cool if we could, but only if it's safe.
Right.
And then I don't know if they would give me a budget to bring in some headliners or not, or if it's just the usual local guests. But I think everybody by that point would probably be itching to do some kind of a con.
Yeah.
So some people would probably drive in that might not normally come in for that one.
Yeah.
So
I think the good thing too is that even if we could only, if it could be relegated to only local guys, there's so much star power within the city that you could put on a really good show even just that way. So we're kind of blessed in that regard, where we could have a local show that could feel almost international in a way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Toronto is a like an A-level city for entertainment.
Yeah.
And it's always been a big hub for comics. And I've always said this all along, is that, generally, we have a huge number of people who live in the GTA in the area, and there's so many comic creators that work for big publishers in the area. So, mm-hmm. Even when I put together a list for Fan Days for the Christmas show, there's like 20 or 30 people.
Right.
So who are off the bat, who are...
I lost you there. It's just frozen for a second, folks.
Ready to go. So.
Sorry, Kev. I lost you there for a sec. It just froze on me. Just give it a sec.
Yep. You okay?
Yeah, I think we're back now. Yeah, there you go. Your screen froze just for a sec.
Sure.
Yeah, no, you were just... Oh, okay. You were saying that we get a lot of people that come just for the Fan Days, 30 people that show up for that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we get the Christmas show gets about 8,000 people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a good number.
Yeah.
And usually it's just more of a fun, let's the exhibitors get a chance to make some money before the end of the year, sell some stuff. You get some Christmas gifts for your family and friends. Maybe get a last minute commission or a sketch or see some of your local friends and dress up or whatever interests you. But, I think if we don't have any shows before that, I could definitely see that one being given a little bit more love.
Yeah, and they might get a jump in attendance this year if that's the case. It'll be something that everyone will want to be at. That's good. Here's hoping. Fingers crossed.
Right. But as I said, always, if it's safe. If it's not safe, then I don't think they're going to allow us to do it. And, that's the risk with any kind of gatherings or events right now, sporting or conventions. It's all up in the air.
Yeah, safety first, for sure. I think the last time we spoke as well, if memory serves, there was a big shakeup at DC Comics with Dan DiDio leaving, and I think we talked about that. And again, we're talking with a big shakeup at DC Comics and what it's doing to may do to the industry. Them leaving Diamond Distributors. Mm-hmm. Were you surprised by that announcement?
I was. I wish I could get my Friday back last week, because as soon as the news broke, it was like every retailer I knew was calling me. What's going on? How is this going to affect me? What do I have to do? Does this mean Diamond is they're dead with Diamond? In the months between, they'd launched their own distributors, right? So they went to Midtown Comics and DCBS and said, well, we're not happy that Diamond is no longer distributing our comics because of the coronavirus. So let's see, do you think you could do this? And so they set this whole company up to distribute the small number of weekly books that were coming out from DC to stores across the across North America. And, at the time when it was announced, a lot of my retailer friends looked into it and then had to weigh the costs versus rewards of it, because most of them were closed.
Right.
So what's the point? So, and then the word from Diamond was, well, if you wait, you'll get those books anyway. So why not just wait? And so I think a lot of them either signed up for accounts and didn't do anything, or chose to go ahead with it in the hopes that the curbside would encourage people to clear out their existing files or maybe buy something from them online. So I hope that worked out for them, because, 2 months there, retailers were not making any money,
right?
Unless they called people up and delivered to their homes or mailed them out and stuff.
Right.
But even then, I think technically the rule was that we were supposed to be closed during the 2 months. And curbside was only allowed until early May, but most people were still doing it all the way through the month of April.
Yeah.
So everything seemed back to normal. But Diamond was shipping stuff again late May. The comics industry seemed to be slowly coming back to life. Marvel was trickling stuff out, so that was a problem. A couple books a week, and then alternating with hardcovers and trades. So that this hit at this point and the way that it was done, I think really sucks. I think that if they choose to do something, they're a company, they're a business, they can make their decisions. If they have an out in their contract and they're not happy with Diamond, as it's clear they're not happy with Diamond, then they're going to do what they have to do. But I think a little bit more heads up, a little bit more clarity would have been a lot better for our retailers.
Mm-hmm.
Because their first reaction is always like, what the hell? Like, I've got to change everything now. This is affecting everything I do. I now have to deal with two distributors. And I think there's like a lot of misinformation about why this was done, and also the breaking of the monopoly, right? So a lot of people think Diamond has a monopoly. They've gone to court. They won that they're not a monopoly, that this is just how things went out. Companies preferred to deal with them exclusively. So if another distributor wanted to start up, they could do that. And that's what we have here. We have two new distributors that have started up, and they're exclusive to DC, and now DC has gone exclusive to them. So we've created another monopoly for DC, right?
Right.
So we have one monopoly which handles everybody except DC, and then now we have the DC monopoly.
So,
and it's,
yeah, sorry, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I think that the people that are upset with Diamond as a monopoly, for the most part that I hear, are more like indie creators and indie publishers who've had bad experiences dealing with Diamond. I don't see how this helps them, unless Diamond is looking to fill the gap left by no longer having DC. But I think most stores aren't going to be ordering more of other types of comics.
No.
They're just going to be dealing with the Marvel distributor and the DC distributor. Right. And the Marvel distributor can get you also Image and Dark Horse and everything else. So,
right.
Yeah.
So just for context, because I find this interesting, and I feel like I know a little about a lot of stuff, but I feel in this regard you're an expert in it, because you were a retailer. You're very closely tied to retailers and just the comic industry in general. But can you give me a bit of a backstory on the direct market distributing history, because this isn't the first time it's been up in a flux where everything's kind of like, now what's going to happen sort of thing. Everyone's got their hands in the air.
Well, I mean, the direct market was really born out of like the 70s. There was the rise of the collector store. So comic shops, mom and pop operations across the country, Canada, the US, UK, they were getting comics secondhand and dealing with them that way. So they were mostly back issue stores. But there were a few distributors that started up in different parts of, like there was a New York-based distributor, a California-based distributor, one here. So I think at one point we had up to 15 or 16 different distributors. But in the late 70s, DC and Marvel made arrangements with those mom and pop stores to sell them stuff directly. So sorry, I itched on my leg.
No problem.
So they made. You know, you could, if you bought the comics non-returnable, you could carry them directly in your store. Where before that, you had to go and buy them off your mom and pop store or your grocery stores or wherever the case is, or from other distributors. And there are, you know, legendary comic collector stories of the 70s of some of these distributors going to, you know, the comic distributors going to the magazine distributors and buying pallets of like Green Lantern, Green Arrow, right off the carton, off the truck. So those books never made it to the local grocery stores and bookstores and so forth. They went right into the direct market. And the way that they gauged sales, the numbers were all skewed. So we knew popular books were not being tracked properly, and the independent news network was reporting low sales when in fact they were being bought out to comic shops. So it's like, anyway, overly complicated, but
no, by the time I enjoy it. It's fine. No problem.
So by the time you get to, let's say, the early 90s, when we've got this huge boom on comics and collectors, Death of Superman, all the stuff going on, Image Comics, Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee, all these big players in the industry. There were multiple distributors. So in Toronto, most of the stores used Andromeda. And Andromeda was a Canadian distributor that was owned by the guy that owned Silversnail, Ron Van Leeuwen. And so you would get your comics from him locally, and he would get them from the various publishers, DC and Marvel and so forth, Aardvark Vanaheim or Dark Horse or whichever were around at the time.
So at that time, sorry to interrupt you, at that time, the Silver Snail was kind of like what Midtown Comics is, where they able to feed all these other smaller stores, but it was like a system that supported Toronto business as far as comics was concerned.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although not every store used Andromeda.
Right.
Some used Diamond, some used Capital City or Seacoast and so forth. So Seagate. And also, you know, different stores would have different product. So if you were a comic fan, you actually kind of hit the stores in the area. So when I, you know, the late 80s and the 90s and so early 90s, I would go to like Dragon Lady, Silver Snail, Third Quadrant, Paradise, various other stores around the city, because each one may be working with a different distributor. So they may have access to different books. And there was that whole indie craze in the 90s, so everyone was looking for the next big thing, the next Turtles.
Right.
Or whatnot.
Right.
So 1994, Marvel decides to buy one of those small distributors, Heroes World Distribution. And they convert it into their own distributor, exclusively doing Marvel product.
Right.
So all the other people that use other distributors could no longer get Marvel. They had to go through Heroes World, set up an account, get their stuff from there. And this kind of set up the mid-90 distributor wars, we call it. Essentially, all these different distributors were left fending. They didn't have one of their two biggest product lines, so Marvel was now off the table for them. So the other major publishers all sort of lined up with Diamond eventually and did exclusive contracts with them. So by the time you get to like 1996, you have Diamond Distributors and you have Heroes World. And Diamond was carrying DC Comics, Image Comics, Dark Horse Comics, all the other major publishers, Valiant and so forth. and Heroes World again just has Marvel, but a lot of stores along the way went out of business because they had trouble getting people in if they didn't have Marvel products or they didn't have the other types of publishers. It was a very weird time of boom and bust, and the speculators all left around the same time in like 96, 97. So Marvel's Heroes World was badly mismanaged, had all sorts of problems, and they finally just said, to hell with this, and they went back to and did a Diamond exclusive agreement in 1997. And that's where we've been pretty much to now, where all of the major comic publishers go through one distributor for the comics market. And there may be other smaller distributors that are out there. Like if you're a local store, you may work with Diamond exclusively, or you may go to Penguin Random House to get your graphic novels, or Hachette, or you may go to Grosner out in the West End to buy some of your supplies and some action figures and things like that. There's also a distributor out of Quebec named Universal, one of the few survivors of the 90s distributor wars. So Universal essentially was grandfathered in, and they carry Diamond products, but they can sub-distribute, where if you're a normal store, your agreement is that you won't distribute to other stores. You won't set yourself up as a sub-distributor. But Universal has been able to maintain that. So lots of stuff back and forth. And so this really, the move to set up UCS and Lunar, in a lot of people's mind, parallels what happened with Heroes World.
Just flip now. Now it's DC on the Marvel end.
Exactly. Right. So it's nice to see that Marvel is staying quiet and continue with Diamond. And you know, as a retailer, like, it doesn't matter. If you like DC Comics, you like Marvel Comics, it's not going to make much of a difference to you. You're going to go to your comic shop. You're going to hopefully be able to buy both going forward, and it's going to be no issue. So a lot of this is just behind-the-scenes drama. But to a retailer who has been Diamond exclusive for many years, you place your orders every month. You get your product each week. You go to one place, you get your shipment. Any problems, you deal with one person. You know, there's you know how things work. You know how they get through customs. You know how they get through freight shipping. So your rates are low. Now that's all up in the air. So if you want to go to get your DC comics, Canadian stores in particular have giant headaches right now, because I'll give an example of a friend of mine who went with Lunar for the first week that they offered product on April 27th. So he ordered, it was a small week, I think there are only five or six books, so he ordered $60 his cost comic worth of comics. So that would be probably about $120 worth of retail off the rack without discount comics. So it cost him $60 to get the comics, then it cost him $27 for the shipping with FedEx, and then Canada Customs dinged him another $20 for that. So he's already up now $47 on top of the $59 he paid for the comics. So for $120 worth of product, he's making maybe $10 to $15 worth of that's provided he's selling
all of it,
every copy, which most stores aren't. Most stores are ordering extras to have for the rack. I think the side effect of things the way they are currently is that most retailers will order more to order as opposed to looking to sell more off the rack. Unless it's a guaranteed winner, like, it's a no-brainer that Batman 3 Jokers is going to be massive in August. So everybody's going to order a ton of those, and they're going to order extra for their stores. People will take that risk if they think the product will sell. And I'm just not sure that, aside from, you know, Batman 92 came out this week. Huge, huge hit. People are coming in to get it. It's going to be sold out everywhere. But, you know, most DC titles aren't Batman, or they're not Three Jokers. They're okay sellers, but they're not flying off the rack.
No.
That type of thing. Like, Justice League has an audience.
Yeah.
You know, Aquaman has an audience. The Flash has an audience, but they're not selling hundreds at each store. They're selling dozens.
Right.
So now if I'm faced with the idea of buying product at no profit, I have to really be confident that that product line is bringing people into my store. So, and I think most people will be confident and say that, yes, DC does attract people to their venues. So they will continue to order DC books, but they're going to be much more cautious about it and not go out on the limb. And a few people have also, a few retailers I know have actually reached out. They've been used to getting their graphic novels from Diamond, but they're now going to, you know, like Penguin Random House and set up accounts, and they'll be ordering their graphic novels through them because they get a better discount and the shipping is free as long as they hit certain order minimums. So, and it's all in Canadian dollars. No have to worry about customs. So that's going to be a...
So do you think that the there's going to be, in the long run, the long game maybe for DC is the changing of format to what it is that how they present their product from single issue to this new format of trades? If the risk that you take on having trades in your store of a particular brand is more feasible than the risk that you'll have to take to make sure you order the right amount of a book that's not that you could get stuck with and lose money on.
Right, and I think the shelf life is very low on periodical comics.
Yeah.
So it's unless it's a first appearance or something, there's not a lot of life in the back issue market for recent books.
Right.
So now we did see an upsurge of interest in periodicals over the last 3 years. So back when I had a store, I expected to be selling graphic novels almost exclusively. We opened in 2012. So by 2015, I would say the majority of our sales were coming from single issues. People were buying comics off the rack. So contrary, there were a whole bunch of other reasons why I saw that happening. I mean, one of them was that DMV started carrying new product and discounting it right immediately. So so that had a huge effect on our new issue, new graphic novel sales. But there, you know, it's competition. It is what it is. So, and then the store owners I know, you know, they sell a lot of single issues to people who want to get them signed, or they want to get CGC, or they want to collect a book. They want the best quality copy. So you can't discount that as a retailer. I mean, any dollar is a dollar that helps you pay your rent, helps you pay your employees. You know, you do want to push product that you believe in, and you know, variants are sometimes tough. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to really believe in the benefit of variants. But there is an audience that wants them and spends money, so you're going to support the customers no matter what.
Yeah.
It's so a tough DC's, nut to crack. Sorry, go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
I was just going to say it's a tough nut to crack because the majority of us, I would say, enjoy the reading of comics, whether it's digital format, you know, buying an omnibus, having that library of however you want to sort it out, of almost curating your favorite things. But then there's that other part of us all, and then the speculator aspect of the hobby, where people want that uniqueness, they want that recency, they want to be in the know, because a story could be spoiled for you if you wait to read it in a trade. And because, you know, the industry is a weekly periodical thing built on that still, you don't want to be – I'm guilty of it. I'm that guy who goes in every week, and I'll buy a majority of the trades. I like to read my books in chunks. I like to have a complete story because I find that I fall back and just accumulate single issues a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And they go into a box. I don't want to touch them. So there's that – push and pull of the preferred way to read a story, and the way that they're being made now is to be read that way, right? To be collected and eventually pull out a complete collection of it. But then we all want to be in the know and not miss the big reveal or have that issue that, you know, becomes The Walking Dead. And, you know, so it's tough for a retailer. I can't imagine what it's like. When you were dealing with Diamond, what were the pros and cons of having what I guess some people would call the monopoly distributor of it? Did you have a good relationship dealing with them, or what were the pros and cons of it?
I would say it was mostly positive. I did have issues because, you know, there were times when the store wasn't doing well. So, I was, you know, I maintained my research job. So I paid people to run the store for me. And some weeks the store was just dead. There was nothing. like some parts of sometimes during Toronto, people just leave, and so the you know, your walk-in traffic dies down. People aren't coming in. Bad weather. You know, some winters are particularly harsh. You don't see your customers for weeks on end, and then you're just accumulating boxes full of product that people have ordered, and they're not coming in to pay for it. And that's a problem that all stores face. And then, you know, that's not the distributor's fault, but since you're buying non-returnable product,
right,
you've got to pay that bill every week. And in some cases, you have no control over what's coming. I mean, you do your pre-orders, but you have no control over what your bill is going to be in 2 months. You might know based on the DC schedule, you might say, okay, DC, these are the DC books that will probably be out then. These are the Marvel books at this point. But if you don't have your heavy hitters coming out that week, there's less walk-in traffic. And then sometimes you would get hit. Like the worst would always be the end of the year. There's something about Diamond, the week before Christmas, you get everything that you ordered that you've been waiting months and months on, toys and other things. And you just get this giant shipment of stuff that you can't use, essentially, because you're going to be closed the weekend of Christmas. You can do a Boxing Day sale. You don't want to put new merchandise out for discounted prices. So there was 1 year, I think it was the December of 2014, I got hit with the worst, or 2013. It was, we had that giant ice storm, and then I got hit with like a $9,000 Diamond bill. And I was a small store. I wasn't. Usually my bills were $2,000 or $3,000 a week. So now you've got $9,000 worth of product, and it's like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles coin banks that never sold, that they had canceled, and then they brought the order back. So I had cases of these things, and nobody wanted them. They're like animated style coin banks. I still have them. I put them in bags for $20, four for $20. They were retailing at $25. Mm. But you get hit with this kind of stuff. You take these risks. And even when you try to plan ahead, like, okay, Diamond canceled this order, but I still think I can sell five of these things. So you do five of each. And then next thing you know, they've reinstituted, and you've got 25 of these things. And those were the ups and downs of dealing with them. And you know, they give you terms, and sometimes you can make your payment and sometimes you can't. And when you can't, then it spirals to the point where you owe them a lot of money. And so at one point I owed Diamond a lot of money, and they were very good about setting terms that allowed me to pay it back. So the one good thing about Diamond is that they float a lot of stores during the bad times. So they're not going to close your account unless you're really desperate. But you know, if you can't pay your bill, they'll allow you to set up a payment reschedule. So maybe you can't pay it this week. So what they'll do is take that amount and then they'll break it up over the next 8 weeks. So you get 200 extra on your next bill until it's all taken care of. Most places aren't going to do that. And a big concern that some publisher friends of mine have brought up is, can the new guys handle the fact that retailers aren't always able to pay? You know, they may give them terms for a week or two, but are they going to be willing to go 3 or 4 months where people haven't paid their bills? And in most industries, it's completely unacceptable for that to happen. But with the comics industry, because it's a small business and Diamond believes in stores, you know, despite all the problems that we've had with them, I think that's the benefit of dealing with them.
Right.
So
yeah. Ultimately, the one who's really going to get hurt by this right now is going to be the retailers. The fans won't know as much of a difference because they'll go to their store, buy what they want, if it's there, and if it's not there, they'll go to another store. But the retailers are the ones who are going to have that headache, especially the Canadian ones, because of now this transferring of goods over the border and all this extra cost that is involved. What do you think the good is that could come from this? Is there any benefit that comes from it?
I can't see any benefit, to be honest, other than that I don't see any benefit, to be honest. I mean, it is what it is, and it's a new reality, and so stores will adjust and they'll buy from these things. But like, I think it was kind of a, I mean, I understand now, I'm learning more and more why they made the decision now. But I think blaming it on coronavirus and Diamond being shut down, because Diamond had to shut down, being in states where the governors were saying you had to close your business down.
Right.
Like here, we had to close our businesses down. So stores were not really open to receive product. And if I let, like, I think if I were open and Diamond was still shipping to me while I was closed, I would be out of business because I would be receiving thousands of dollars of product each week that no one could come and buy.
Yeah.
I'd have to go to my car and put it all in my car and drive to people's houses and beg them to put on a mask and let me drop it off to their door, and hopefully they've got the money on hand to pay for their bills. Which is why a lot of retailer friends of mine had like very panicked months trying to make money to pay their rent.
Right.
Retail rent does not go down.
No.
Your landlords do not sympathize with you for the most part.
Yeah.
Most retail properties are mortgaged as well, so they need that money that you provide them to pay their own mortgage.
Yeah.
So if you don't pay them, they're screwed too. So they have no forgiveness. And government plans to help retailers, better in Canada than in the US for sure, but it's taken a long time to get those programs up and running. So, you know, some stores that you think are perfectly fine that have very long history in the business are, I know from the conversation I'm having, that they're struggling. They need business. People are not shopping the way they used to. It's great that comics are back and people are coming in to get their, now that Batman is out this week, people are going in to get Batman. So the reports are great, sales are good, but during those off days, like the Thursdays, the Fridays, and so forth, it's quiet. You know, you're not getting a lot of random walk-in traffic.
Yeah.
You're getting your hardcore traffic. And it's going to take a long time for that to get sort of back on track,
Yeah. People
especially
have
when we're
started
still
new
dealing with
routines.
other elements of the shutdown.
Yeah. People have
So.
started new routines, right? Your routine is disturbed. You want it to come back, but you've learned how to function without those things for a little bit, and then getting back into that same old thing that you were used to, that ritual of it. That's a big part of, I think, this hobby. There becomes a ritualistic aspect of it. And when there's all these different ways now you can get books when you can't go to the store, I'm guilty of it. I shopped on Amazon when I couldn't go outside if I needed something, if I could avoid going to a grocery store to get a certain product, or if I did want to get a book, I can't go to any bookstore, right? So what do? We're gonna go other avenues, and that just becomes, I guess, your new normal, your new convenience. So getting back into those things of remembering, like, yeah, let's go back to that. And people are still scared, right? That's the other thing. You still got that half of that contingent of people who are concerned of going into these small shops, right? So it's
Well, and
bad timing,
that's a
I
big
feel
problem.
like.
I think a lot of retailers learned that they needed an online platform.
Yeah.
If they didn't have one going, they had to get one up and running as quickly as possible. And some are still struggling, but others did well.
Right.
Like I know a few stores that actually turned around and did very well because the product they were offering, with the exchange rates going the way they were, people were buying from Canadian retailers because it was cheaper. We hadn't adjusted our rates to adapt to the changing exchange rates. So they sent a lot of things like statues and figures and things like that to American customers because the price was too good.
Right.
You
Yeah.
know,
That's good.
but the you know you th we talked earlier about how we're looking for things to do to leave the house and so forth. So I would say, build in a ritual where you make a trip to a comic shop once a week. Put on your mask,
Yeah.
and go. Your retailer will appreciate your
Yeah.
visit.
Yeah.
You know, show some love to the comics industry. Comics have always traditionally been recession-proof, in that we still want our comics. You know, even if the economy is not that great and other things aren't doing as well, people have gone to their comic shops and bought stuff. And so, in some cases, we've done as well or better than other parts of the economy while things are going on. But that requires us to be open and selling comics in order to do that. And so now that we're sort of back, like, see what we can do. See if you can support. If you got to go to the grocery store and wear a mask, unless you're just not leaving the house at all, even then, I think you can call up your local store and make some arrangements to see if they'll drive it by your house or something like that. That's still possible.
Yeah. I know my local comic book shop, Cyber City, Darryl was doing that. And he put on a couple of sales. It was like a stay-at-home sale where things were discounted at a real reasonable rate. So I was able to purchase some things from him. He had his online store running. Yep. I mean, he had to do a lot of work to get it to work. So, but like you said, having those options there for the... It's in times like these where you realize it's adapt or die, right? And, you know, we're more and more and more becoming... digital world where a lot of people even may not ever have to go back to their office job if they can do a lot of things through Zoom. So having that digital option to purchase, I think, is just going to become more and more necessary.
And you know, I saw a lot of collector friends just turn to online auctions to buy back issues and original art. And they were dropping a lot of money on these things. And this is money they might normally have spent each week at their comic shop.
Right.
Looking for issues or going to shows to spend money on issues, which is why the charity, the Canucks for Comics, was very important. So that sort of came about by a few people were asking, why don't we have a charity for comics retailers in Canada like Bink does in the States, the book industry, I can't remember what the I think it's Book Industry Charitable Foundation. But they did a bunch of auctions led by Jim Lee and others, art auctions, back issues, things like that, raised a lot of money for comic shops, but none of that could go to Canadian shops. Right. So we did a few retailers asked me if there's any charities I know of that could do it. And the Schuster's aren't really in the position to do that. We're not for profit, but we don't really take any money in. So the fine fellows at the Comic Legends Legal Defense Fund out west, they have an office here, but they're based in Vancouver and Calgary for the most part, their heads. So they set up the auctions and ran it, which is great. They've raised over $40,000 to help Canadian stores pay their rent so that they don't close as a result of coronavirus. And then those four stores in Ontario did that whole online event, Be Our Heroes Canada, which did raise, I think, they raised another of the 42 that Canucks for Comics raised. I think 15 or so came from Be Our Heroes Canada auctions. And what was great about that was they gave a number of different stores a chance to show off what they were about. So you went to the store, the retailer showed off the types of products that they had, and then gave you the option to bid and buy them online through the live stream. So I think. Great idea, and I hope that they do more of it going forward. And I think the live experience, the online live experience, will replace a lot of the convention stuff that we're definitely going to miss for this year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, big shout out to Martin for Fastball Special, doing those little Sketchomanias he's got going, because I think it's nice to have that sense of the sketch battle happening. And you know, sometimes you get some really big artists that tune in and watch. So it's a nice little community being built. So it's nice to see us, what's the word, kind of innovate in this time of shutdown.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that sort of leads into what I'm doing right now with Fan Expo, is that we're launching a bunch of these live experiences to make up for the lack of cons. So two were announced this week. One was later this month they're going to start. So one is with John Barrowman from Doctor Who and Arrow. And so he'll do a live stream Q&A, and then people can donate money to charity. And then I think there's an autographing element to it, but I didn't see it when I looked online. I know that we are in the process of working on the contracts with comic creators to do the same thing.
That's cool.
So I should hopefully have some news within a week or two of our first of these live streams, and we can do, the hope is that we'll do something like every day there'll be something where we do like a Q&A or like the equivalent of a comic panel where you get a Q&A with a creator about what's going on with their work, and they can take some questions from the audience, or maybe an artist does a live drawing demo for fans so you can see the process. We've got some great sponsors lined up for this, so I'm looking forward to the official announcement of that. But that will be a big deal when it comes out in a week or so. And that will definitely keep me busy as I'm waiting to do cons again. So,
Yeah, that's good.
yeah.
That's good. That's exciting. So you said in the beginning that, you know, this summer it's been a, you know, quiet, you're not traveling, you're at home reading, watching movies. Do you got a top five list of things you can recommend to us of all the stuff that we could be doing? Well, we
Oh
do
man,
have more
yeah.
downtime to ourselves.
Well, there's so much material out there, so much to watch.
Yeah.
So coming, I tried to come up with a top five list, and I've had a hard time. I really binged on Star Wars
Okay.
during this, and so I've watched all the 9 films, 10 films, I should say. No, actually, it's 11 films. I keep forgetting that.
Solo.
So yeah, Solo and Rogue One.
Yeah.
So 11 films, plus The Mandalorian, plus Clone Wars. If you haven't watched Clone Wars, that's great. 6 seasons of that, or 7 seasons of that, and the ending was fantastic. The one that came out a few weeks ago,
I always hear good
and
things about it, but I've never watched it. But I always hear wonderful things about it.
it's so clunky and awful at the beginning,
Okay.
but by the time you get to the third season, you're hooked. It's great.
Okay.
And then Rebels, the same thing. You think it's a kid's show, but by the time you get to the end of the first season, you realize that this is sort of the sequel to Clone Wars, and it's you're getting a lot of characters coming in, like Darth Vader and Grand Moff Tarkin and Grand Admiral Thrawn and people like that.
I started
So
reading the
it's
Thrawn trilogy actually as a recommendation from Fred Kennedy. I read the first book so far. And I enjoyed that. I'm sad that it's not canon anymore. And but I would have loved to see that movie or a spin-off of that movie be made. But it's a good book. It's still Star Wars.
Yep.
If you like Star Wars and you want to get a fix, it's still great.
Well, if you're on YouTube and you're following all the news sites, there's literally Star Wars news every day. A lot of rumors and stuff. So there's a big rumor going around that they're casting Grand Admiral Thrawn, and they're going to build him up to be the big bad for the Disney Plus series, all set around the same time. So when Ahsoka and other characters appear in The Mandalorian, it's going to lead to hopefully a live action Ahsoka series and maybe something with Grand Admiral Thrawn as well, like a mini series.
Okay,
They're
that'll be cool.
doing the approach of Marvel Universe building, so all of these different shows will connect,
Ah, I like that.
and he'll be their big bad, if that's provided they do this right. So
Okay, yeah. Which is your favorite of the trilogies? How would you rank them?
Well, obviously the original trilogy, 4, 5, 6,
Number one.
classic.
Yeah.
Then I would probably go 1, 2, 3. I mean, I really despise Phantom Menace. It's just an awful movie. It's just I remember thinking it was all right, and then seeing when George did the 3D conversion of Phantom Menace, that pretty much killed Lucasfilm, that he made the deal to sell right after that, is that it's unwatchable. It's like just not a good film. Although Dave Filoni redeemed it recently, he did something for the Mandalorian Gallery show, where
Okay.
there he talked about how important the Phantom Menace is, the most important of the 9 movies, essentially, because the entire fate of Anakin Skywalker and Darth Vader and his children and everything else is all settled in that film with the Duel of the Fates between Qui-Gon Jinn and Darth Maul, because whoever wins that comes out in charge. Will win Anakin's soul and determine the future of the Chosen One. So Qui-Gon Jinn is like the father figure that believes in him, and so losing him, he looks for another father figure, and he ends up with Palpatine as that person, and it sort of leads things down on him. Anyway,
Context always helps,
yes,
right? Yeah.
exactly.
Okay,
And
okay.
the new trilogy was is just a series of okay effects and disappointment. So
I kind of
I
feel like the
really am
new
one of those people that hated The Last Jedi, and the new one, the last one, Rise of Skywalker, just seemed like it was, let's fix what happened in The Last Jedi and throw in everything in the kitchen sink to try to wrap up this whole 9 film sequence. So
Yeah, The Last Jedi really threw me for a loop. I left the theater not knowing why. I know some people love it, they can defend it. That's fine. It took me out of the I was in a Star Wars craze at the time. I was reading the comics, I was watching the movies, I was, you know, all into it. And then that movie happened, and I was just like, I think for me, where Star Wars was as far as the movie franchise, the Marvel universe replaced it for me at that point. I said, everything that I wanted from this new thing gives it to me the way I beyond what I imagine it to be.
Right.
And I think that looking back at the last trilogy, it kind of feels like the way I look back at Superman Returns, it was an attempt to pay homage to that wonderful movie, and it did its best to try to recreate moments in that, but you just can't. In a way, it was almost like the trilogy all over again. The classic trilogy, trying to redo it, telling that story with new characters, and it had its moments. Yeah. It had its moments.
You can't. I mean, Superman Returns was basically Superman 2. Yeah. No, it was Superman the movie, I should say.
Yeah.
All over again.
Pretty much.
So it's like, sometimes you can't go home. You can pay homage, but you got to forge ahead and do something unique. And I mean, that's a whole problem with Superman movies is it's either Lex Luthor or it's General Zod. I mean, can we get something else with Superman? Can we get away from the origin story or with Lex Luthor wanting property or, you know, or General Zod wanting to come back for revenge on his dad?
Yeah. I feel like Superman has a much better rogues gallery than people give him credit for. I would put him in top 4 of the rogues gallery in comics. I would put Spider-Man, Batman, then they always say, you know, the Flash has the rogues gallery because it just the name itself is, it belongs to the Flash. But after that, I would say Superman's got a great list of characters that are villains, and they're all different. They all challenge him differently. I just think they're misused a lot of times. I don't know if they don't translate well to the screen, but a Brainiac as a villain, that'd make an incredible movie.
Yeah, Brainiac seems an obvious waste that they haven't done it. I think of, you know, like there was that great story arc in the late 80s and early 90s with Superman questioned himself and he flew into space and he ended up on War World.
I'm reading that right now, actually, The Omnibus Exile. It's a great story.
Really good stuff. And so, I mean, why not do an adaptation of that where you have Superman is depowered, he's on War World, or he's at least fighting people who are of his level, and it becomes a survival story, there are all sorts of possibilities there that they just don't explore.
I thought they would go there with the Henry Cavill character, that crisis of conscience of, I did something that I can't live with myself, and I'm a danger. So there's that need to exile. Like, I thought that's where they might take the story, but didn't happen.
No, that's a whole mess. I mean, I am looking forward to the Snyder Cut. Even though I'm not a huge fan of Zack Snyder, the Justice League movie is just so awful that if anyone can redeem it, that might do it. So even a dark and gritty version. So
yeah, that's a shame. Mm-hmm. What else? What else you got going on?
So I do watch a lot of movies for this movie review podcast I do every 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
But I can't think of anything I like super loved. That's okay. I mean, I've seen a lot of films, but I'm working my way through Fringe, which is a series I love, a television show.
Okay, I think was that with Joshua Jackson?
Yeah.
Okay. I heard about that show. Like a multiple timeline, right? Like dual timelines taking place?
Yeah, there's a lot of comic stuff in there. So it starts out as a division of the FBI that investigates weird stuff. And then it sort of develops into parallel Earths and sort of along the lines of Earth 1, Earth 2.
Yes.
So some character, a major character turns out to have been taken from an alternate Earth, and that Earth is occupying the same space and is being affected by it. So as the time goes by, there's more chance of one world being destroyed in favor of the other. And so it's like a war between different realities. And and trying to find a device that can deal with that. And then there's the version of the Watchers from Marvel Comics. So these bald guys that wear dark suits that are always around at important moments in history.
Oh, okay.
And then that turns into probably the worst season. So the last season is not a favorite of mine. It just turns out that they were time traveling conquerors from a different reality. And so you go into the future and the main characters have a child who's an adult now. Kind of reminds me of how Arrow ended up with adult children of the modern stars. Fighting along with them to free them from an oppressive regime. It's just didn't work for me. So
yeah, sometimes a show can go that one season too long and then it just messes everything up that you had going to wrap it up. Yeah, I feel you.
Yeah. But I'm on season 3 and it's great. It's moving along very well.
That's cool.
Yeah, so I don't know. And then comics-wise, at the beginning of the pandemic, I realized I had over 700 Marvel comics that came out last year that I hadn't read.
Okay.
So I started working my way through that. So I think I'm down to about 400 now.
Nice.
That I haven't read yet. So, but I have revisited some graphic novels, and some new ones have come out in the last few weeks that have been really good, like the DC First Issue Specials collection and the Tales of the Batman. Steve Englehart was a good one.
Yeah, I'd like to get my hands on that. That's a nice collection. I agree with you about the trade dress. Those trade dresses on those are horrible. They do not make it look appealing, because that's some of the most, I've always heard that that's some of the most influential Batman stories, where he did something with the character that wasn't typical, but it's kind of been now in the mythos and inspired a lot of what we would see in movies and things like that, that Steve Englehart put into place. So I'd like to get those.
My problem with whoever's doing the book designs for them, the Tales of the Batman, the Legends of the Dark Knight, and the Adventures of Superman line. I mean, here you have characters with the most recognizable, iconic logos in publishing.
Yes.
And you take what is essentially Times Roman and throw it on the cover and put Tales of the Batman, Steve Englehart. It's like unappealing, boring, black and like, I don't know, olive lettering, and it's the coloring's terrible. And then they blow up panels, and they do two blow up panels, one for the top, one for the side, and on this black background. And it's just, it's like they've hired high school students in a design program to make these things. Yeah. I think high school students would do better jobs.
Yeah.
Than this. It's like, nothing wrong with the content of the books. Content's great. As long as they can get the right content released to people, like The Adventures of Superman, George Perez, the content, table contents that they released to everyone from Amazon and Diamond and so forth was completely different from what was actually in the published book.
Yeah.
I was surprised when I got it to find that it contained New 52 Superman. So, I mean, I've read those books and I didn't really think I was going to be revisiting them, but there they were, and sort of stuck in the back of this book, which had some great stuff like that. Again, coming off the tail end of that Gladiator storyline.
Yeah, The Exile. Yeah, George Perez was on the book. I don't know how long, but he was on Superman for a little bit.
Yeah, maybe a year.
Yeah,
if that. But I think he was writer, and he didn't pencil and ink every issue, but he was involved in some of the art choices.
Yeah,
sort of a return to status quo Superman. So they're just good, solid Superman stories.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting to that portion of the omnibus. I've read the Exile story before and I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So
reading
those issues, because Superman is a hard character to collect. I think he's because now they're talking about, or they are going to release the Man of Steel hardcover. But when you look at the contents of what's listed on Amazon, it looks like an omnibus. It looks like it's going to be 1,000 pages, but then the page count's only 496, which clearly that's not going to have all the material that's listed there. It's impossible.
Yeah, because originally it was solicited as an omnibus, and then they changed it to just sort of a deluxe hardcover. And so from what I understand, the first volume is the contents from... So I don't know if you know the Man of Steel trades.
Yeah.
That series.
I have them all.
There were 8 volumes of that. So 2 trade volumes will make up one of the new hardcovers.
Okay.
So Man of Steel. So Man of Steel miniseries 1 to 6, and then the first 6 or so issues of Action and Superman and Adventures of Superman will all fall in under the first volume of this new deluxe version.
That's a nice set. I have all of the other trades already, which they just finished. I think they stopped at 9 with the Supergirl saga. That might have been when Byrne got off the book. But again, it's because they crisscross. They always crisscross between Adventures and Action and Superman. It's not something that is as easily collectible like some other series, like a you know, you can do an Amazing Spider-Man, or you can do an X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, Chris Claremont and Byrne era type of thing. Superman's old, especially the really good stuff that kind of stuck around, because Bronze Age stuff is kind of wonky. Superman, you've got.
I remember
moments,
not caring about Superman until Byrne came onto it in '86.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they did a, like, I read Superman every week. Week after week until I want to say like the late 90s, like pretty much 10 years of a weekly Superman book. And they had the diamonds on them so you could follow the stories. And I think that this is, I mean, you talk about where we're going with comics. I think that people need that guide. So if you're going to go present old material, you can't just throw out a graphic novel and say, Superman, Panic in the Sky, here you go. You need that context. You need to know what part of the story this is. So you could go back and you could retool your trade paperback program to say, you know, we have ages. We have the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Golden Age, the Modern Age. You could turn around and say, okay, this is where Silver Age Superman starts, Volume 1. And you could have Golden Age Volume 1, and then you could do thick omnibus style trades like Epic Collections.
That'd be nice.
And do it that way.
That'd be nice.
So Spider-Man is a little bit different in that you could pretty much say Spider-Man, you could put, this is Epic Collection 42 of X number. Because you know that they can retool, they're going to do essentially what they're doing with this Superman line. They can say, okay, these are the Spider-Man books that came out during this time period. And so this compromises volume 42. We've carved out the entire history of Spider-Man into set volumes. And while not every volume comes out in sequence, they jump around quite a bit as they remaster the material. But they try to present a storyline, but 2 years worth of comics.
Yeah, there's a timeline that you are invested in that book. Even though you start and all these other things have happened, you kind of, once you start reading that book, you know where you're at. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think if you were, so DC, the current car that the DC dog is chasing is the young adult bookstore market.
Yeah.
And they're printing out all these graphic novels that aren't of interest to most people who buy monthly comics. They're like Swamp Kid. Okay. It looks like Dog Man, but it's Swamp Thing. But it's a kid who has swamp powers. Okay. It might be awesome. If you're 10 years old, it might be the best book ever. But if you're a Swamp Thing person, it doesn't interest you. You don't care. Like, if I read Batman, why would I want to read the story about teen Bruce Wayne getting his first car? That doesn't matter. That's not of interest to me. The artwork isn't appealing to me. But I can accept that there might be an audience for that in the young adult section of a bookstore. But that seems to be the market that they're currently looking to chase.
Mm-hmm.
They've had some success with some Teen Titans graphic novels to hit that sort of that 8 to 15 range. But I think once you get to 15, then you're pretty good with mainstream comics. If it appeals to you, then you're gonna read what you find, what crosses your path that interests you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I think that with the way comic stores are and the way that comics are distributed, most people aren't going to see the periodical comics at all, ever, unless they go to a local comic shop or they go to a comic book convention or something. It's just a general, you know, in the world of bookstores, you don't see a lot of comics.
No.
And if you're in a community that doesn't have any comic shops, then you'll never see any. So graphic novels are means of reaching new people, so I know they want to chase that dog. If I were retooling my graphic novel department, I would say I would take that John Byrne graphic novel and I would say this is Superman Volume 1. And I put that out there and I'd do a proper cover on it. And then I would do every 2 to 3 months, I would do a $30 trade reprinting 2 years worth of Superman stories. And then I would have a bunch to put on the bookshelf. I maybe not even do them normal comic size of 8x10. I might do them 7x9 and in a thicker format, more like Captain Underpants, that kind of binding, and put them out there and just get people, anything that gets people hooked and reading and interested in storylines.
Yeah, because Marvel has that those differently cut graphic novels that's about 12 issues of Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel, Miles Morales, The Champions, that's targeted to a younger audience, books that I read, that I own, that I hold in high regard as a comic book reader, but they could be perfectly, adjusted to a younger audience in their format. And yep. You don't have to go out of your way to put something that, they're winners, they're automatic winners as it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, when I was younger, it was a different ballgame, but my entry to DC and Marvel Comics were things like Secret Origins of the DC Superheroes and The Origins of Marvel Comics, which were hardcover books that were released to bookstores. I was certainly aware of what comics were, but when someone gave me that book, I was interested. And while Marvel was heavily reprinting their comics as comics, so Marvel Tales and things like that, in the late 70s, they did, it might have even been early 80s, like 81, 82, they started doing sequentially numbered paperback collections of 6 issues of Spider-Man and FF and things like that. So they were like paperback size, so they were easily carryable around, but they had Spider-Man 1-6 and AF-15 in them. And I could take that with me everywhere I went. It was in my backpack all the time. Mm-hmm. I still have them somewhere. They're literally falling off. They're falling apart.
Yeah.
And covers are taped on and stuff like that. But that was cheap and they were accessible and they were able to build a big section in the bookstore of these paperbacks. So so all the kids were reading them at the time and that got them into reading other comics.
Right.
And that was long before we had trades and graphic novels.
Right.
In the stores, right? So you didn't see, like, it wasn't until Watchmen and Dark Knight and so forth you started seeing graphic novels in bookstores regularly. Before that, you might see these occasional paperback collections or Superman from the 70s to the 30s to the 70s and things like that. So.
Yeah. I had an Untold Tales of Batman written by Len Wein and John Byrne, Jim Aparo art. I love that book. I read it to death.
You know, and it's perfect. It's a 3-issue history of Batman from the story of his dad right through to the modern day.
I love that.
And
book.
So we need that kind of entry level stuff in the format that most comics are going to be presented at some point. Right. So it could be a graphic novel, whatever. But when it's too radical, like they're trying to put out graphic novels that look like young adult novels that are selling right now. So there's no doubt about it that the biggest comic creator in the world right now is Raina Telgemeier. And her books are New York Times bestsellers, Guts, Drama, Babysitter's Club, Smile. They're just sisters. They're big sellers and they've got an audience and everybody wants a piece of that audience now and is trying to do similar types of graphic novels. So that's all fine and dandy, but I'm not sure that the superhero style of storytelling can be so easily reformatted with the same type of artwork and the same type of personal storytelling, right?
Yeah.
You can't make Superman into an indie comic easily. You can tell a Superman story like an indie comic, but it may or may not sell.
Yeah. It might be a critical hit, and it might have a shelf life in like a graphic novel type of thing, but initially it might not register with anybody. It's true.
Right. and it's not going to turn you on to a Jim Lee Superman story.
No.
Or someone like that. It's just going to be so, it's too different. It's like apples and oranges.
Yeah.
And it would be great if they were trying to sell apples and oranges and grapes and tomatoes and everything else and bananas. But they seem to focus on, we just want apples right now. Right. And so we want the apples to sell. So the oranges are going to suffer and right. the bananas are going to suffer. So this is where we're going. We want our sales to the direct market to be more like apples. So we are going with a new distributor to, you know, to sell the apples. And our main focus is on bookstores, which is where we sell the most apples. And even though bookstores sell our oranges too, we don't care so much about our oranges. We want the apples to sell because we think that's the future of the medium.
Yeah. Do you think the format, I was going to ask you that. Do you think the format is eventually going to be changing now with these new type of distributing options and just how where books are being sold?
Well, I think that the format's already there. I mean, we've already made these changes. We have so many format options out there.
Yeah.
That you know, there's no need to even pick one. But I think the periodical is the, you know, and people have been saying this since before I was born, is how long will comics survive as comics, as single issue periodicals, 32 page pamphlets or you know, up to 100 pages. I'm sure they'll be fine, but I think that this move and the way that people are going to order and that we talked again about shipping and stuff like that, I think that stores will prioritize the books that sell and the books that don't sell, which is the majority of the line, will suffer. And they'll say, it's like self-justification. We don't think these are doing very well. We don't want to put our effort into making them better. We assume that they should be selling because we are making them.
Right.
And this is a problem that is with a lot of businesses face. They say, all right, I'm, you know, like, you could say, okay, we're Fan Expo. We're the biggest show on the planet. But if we're offering a terrible product, people aren't going to go. People are just going to start walking away. And they might go to another show down the line. And they might want to spend their money there. And then you get more and more people hating on us online and stuff like that. So we have to take the hate and say, what are we doing wrong? What can we make better?
Right.
What can we improve on? And so what I'm seeing is not... I'm seeing the hate online of people, and this is a problem again with online. Everybody hates everything.
Right.
Is that you could say the books aren't very good. I think the consensus among most people is there are good books, definitely, but a lot of the books aren't very good. So instead of trying to make them better, they just get mad at the audience for hating on the books. And so eventually they'll just cancel those books and come up with another book that fits that same niche. And maybe it'll sell or maybe it won't. But when you keep putting out books that aren't selling or are only mediocre selling, at some point you have to say, there's no audience for this book. I mean, I'm going to use Daphne Byrne, and I'm nothing against Daphne Byrne. It might be a great seller. But I could say nobody cares about the single issue of Daphne Byrne, but they do care about the trade paperback. So why do I want to release the single issues of Daphne Byrne when it's a waste of my effort to put them out as periodicals? I could just put it out as a graphic novel with a Joe Hill name on it and sell a lot of books.
Right.
Because my periodical audience doesn't give a crap about that single issue. And I'm not saying that there aren't people that do care. There are going to be some people that do. But if the sales are under 20,000 copies of a comic, then clearly you're not appealing to very many people.
Right.
So, but your graphic novel might sell 20,000 copies on its own, and that's a great selling graphic novel.
Right.
So,
you got to pick which way you're going to go about it. Yeah. There's some books where you know that, I mean, I bought Omega Men as a single issue because it was very well received and critically acclaimed. Now, when I went to meet Tom King to get him to sign it, he's like, oh, so you're the one who bought this book. Because they were going to cancel it after issue 5 or 8 because no one was buying it. Thankfully, they didn't because he got to complete his story. Yeah. But that book, as a graphic novel, is a whole other life.
Yep.
On its own, right?
Say, I think of Watchmen.
Right.
You know, at the time, Watchmen came out, and Watchmen did not appeal to me at all on any level. I think I bought the first issue, and I'm like, I don't like this. This is just too different. It's not my thing. But then I got the graphic novel, and I'm like, I still don't like this, but I can see where it's going, and I like elements of it. By the time I get to the third or the fourth reading, I'm now greatest graphic novel ever. You can see the genius of Alan Moore, all that stuff. But if you were buying it on a monthly basis, it's just another comic you read, you throw it on the pile, whatever the case. So I could see them saying, we don't need to do all of these comics. We're making the money with graphic novels. Why don't we just start? We're now doing these graphic novels for young adults that are just graphic novels. There's no sequential story. Like, it's no period. We're not breaking into periodicals first and then publishing it. So that's breaking that mold that DC and Marvel believe that you have to put out single issues and then collect them and then make the money as the book. Bypass that. Just put it out as a book. Do what every other company does. Scholastic is an example. They just put out graphic novels. There's no periodicals.
Yeah.
You know. So maybe with other types of genre, you could just put out a horror graphic novel and make your money on it that way, instead of trying to put it out as a collectible issue that no one is buying.
Yeah.
So most of the line could be cut back, and you could say, you could retool your monthly line into, and this is something I've been saying all along, is you could just put out 5 or 6 graphic novels a month, and you could collect the material that you would have put in Superman and Action and other similar themed books and just group them into a trade paperback. And then you have like manga magazines that have all like Shonen Jump and so forth. I mean, I'm dating myself that 20 years or 30 years, but like that material, you could go to the store and buy the one Superman volume that's out this month, and it has all the new Superman comics in it, right? Or the Batman. You know, certain characters will sell at a certain level. So you know Batman will sell. You could do Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Justice League, Teen Titans, and then Heroes of the DC Universe or Vertigo-style horror-type comics. You could group those characters together, and you don't necessarily have to have a lead feature every month. You could rotate stuff in and out. It does change the way that we present comics, but if single issues aren't selling, then, you know, what would sell?
Yeah.
What could we reach? So Marvel, on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I get my single issue Marvels every week. I put in my digital code. I load up my iPad. They're there. I can read them whenever.
Yeah.
I sell my single issues. I get some of my money back. But I don't want to have boxes full of Marvel comics all over my apartment. I have my iPad, you know, with right. All of my stuff on it. So that, to me, I prefer that. And then if it's really good, then I'll buy the hardcover.
Right.
And with DC, that, because I don't have that option with DC where I can't buy the DC comic, plug in a code and read it later on my iPad, I have to go to Comixology and buy the book. And, you know, just doesn't work for me on a financial level to do that.
Yeah.
So I subsidize the cost of my new issues by buying the comic, loading the iPad, and then selling the physical comic down the line. So I make some of that money back. So I'm getting it around the cost of what I would get if I were buying it 6 months from now.
Right.
And I'm able to read it because I just want to read it. So with DC stuff, I tend to just follow what people are interested in, and like on occasion look at other people's books as I'm sorting them and just say, oh, that looks interesting. I'm going to earmark that to get the trade when it comes out in 6 months.
Right.
And that's another problem with DC, is that they take way too long to get out the hardcovers and the trades of the books that are of interest.
Yeah, I haven't been liking how their new format. I enjoyed the way they did Rebirth. It felt like they were coming out at a good pace that you could keep up with if you were reading the trades. And then when they stopped the Rebirth trade dress era, Then they started to put things out in hardcover first. So then you know, if everything's are, I don't know, we're these nerdy completionists and we want our shelves to have this uniformity. I'm not going to suddenly switch over to this format and you know, have I did that in the beginning when I started recollecting comics, and I have like half of my Green Lantern sets in soft cover, half in hardcover, and it's irritating. It's not a big problem. First world problems, but it's just one of those things where it's like, can't you just put them out so people can collect the way they want to?
Right. It drives me crazy. Doomsday Clock. Huge book.
Right.
Great book. Really good. But, you know, okay, so we have a hardcover that has 6 issues, and then we have to put in a hardcover that has another 6 issues. But the first hardcover comes out when the series is done, or almost done. And then the second hardcover is going to come out 6 months after the series is finished. We're moving on to other things by this point. So now I've got to buy 2 hardcovers and put them in a slipcase hard. That's not how I ultimately want that book in my collection. Why not give me the thick 12-issue hardcover as soon as the 12-issue miniseries is done?
Right.
And then concurrently have a trade paperback if people just want to read it. Instead of, you know, maybe they don't want to spend $50 on a hardcover, they could get $30 on a trade.
I agree. It's like when people would release, I mean, we're getting real nerdy about it, but like when you release DVDs, here's the bonus, one of the bonus features, here's a 4K version, here's just the DVD version. How do you want to enjoy, do you want it in 3D? It's all there if you want it that way. Give me a hardcover option, give me a soft cover option, give me one that has, you know, all of the notes from the creator or what have you. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know what the cost effectiveness is of that, but I think these are things that would maybe solve problems or make stores and retailers have that sort of wiggle room to be able to. Because I know my shop, Daryl says, you know, I'm not going to order the hardcover because it's a risk that I'm taking that a lot of people are going to wait for. So unless you ask me directly for it, I will get it for you. So sometimes I'll go to the store with the assumption that it'll be there. And I'll be like, hey, I came to pick up this book. He's like, yeah, I only order that when people ask for it. And I'm like,
yep.
Great. He goes, when it comes to soft cover, I'm going to have it. All right. So I got to wait another, you know, I'll order it now.
Because, you know, as a retailer and you have confidence in a product, you can sell it off the rack. You can usually, and you believe in it. Like Saga was a big deal before I closed the store. And we would sell Saga all day, every day. Walking Dead, Invincible. I could sell Invincible trades every day.
Right.
You know, like if you're looking for a good, solid superhero story with not a lot of continuity, here you go. Pick up volume 1. If you don't like this, no problem.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you'll be back for volume 2.
For sure.
And almost all the time they were back for volume 2. That's the type of thing you could go and you could sell this stuff. But if it's all expensive this, expensive that, when is this coming out? Is it coming out? That's another thing with DC is that you might, like the Superman Man of Steel omnibus as an example, right? So they solicited it and then they decided not to put it out. So they canceled it. I guess the orders weren't there or they just decided it wasn't the right format for them. But you're stuck then retooling. And I feel like I'm blaming DC a lot, but all the publishers are guilty of this in some level. Mm-hmm. You know, what does your audience want? Get it out in that format as quickly as possible, and you'll have your 40-year sales of Watchmen.
Yeah.
You know, the Watchmen trade sold as a trade paperback for decades. Dark Knight Returns, the same thing. Then you can do your anniversary hardcover editions. You can do your absolute editions, all that stuff. But the trick is to get it out in a single volume in people's hands so they can read it. And the more you delay that, the more you drag it out, you know, the less chances you're going to get people getting to enjoy it. You know that eventually they will, but we're waiting for years for that to happen. So
yeah, what's the one thing you're looking most forward to getting your hands on? Whether you've ordered it, if it's already, you know, you're about to pick it up, or it's about to come out. What's that thing for you right now?
You know what? I pre-order stuff every month, so I have to think of what really interests me and makes me happy. I think there's a second, the Absolute Swamp Thing Volume 2 is coming out in a few weeks. I'm really looking forward to that because I love that run of Swamp Thing. And I the first volume of the Absolute, I was super impressed with it. The coloring, the clarity of the artwork, and the story, of course, is classic. And the whatever material they use for the cover itself has a mossy feel to it. So it's like a visceral.
Cool.
You feel like you're part of the swamp
when
you're reading it. So.
That's cool.
And then there's a Legends of the Dark Knight Matt Wagner collection, or Tales of the Batman. I don't remember which one. I'm sure it'll have a terrible trade dress, but Matt Wagner's Batman stuff is fantastic. I have some art from Batman versus the Mad Monk, but there's also Batman and the Monster Men.
Yeah.
One other one, which I can't remember what it is, but Faces is part of that as well. But Matt Wagner is one of my favorite storytellers, and
I love Trinity. Trinity is fantastic.
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is if you're a fan and you don't have those trades already, I highly recommend this one.
Okay.
And then down the line, obviously I'm looking forward to the hardcover of the Burn stuff. I already have the trades, so it's not like it'd be a revelation.
My dog ate my volume one Man of Steel, so I need to get something to replace that one.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. So
I still have that first trade they did of Man of Steel with the black cover.
That's the one she ate.
Just had this. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was not an easy one to find anymore, so I got to find something to replace it.
And then I'm super excited that they're doing a Wrath of the Spectre omnibus. I've always liked that character, the Spectre. So the core of it, the meat of it, is that four-issue miniseries and trade that they call Wrath of the Spectre, which were really backup stories from Adventure Comics in the 70s. Jim Aparo, Michael Fleischer, really radical stuff where the Spectre turns his hand into a chainsaw and cuts a guy, turns him into a log and then cuts him into like salami.
Oh.
Things like that. But they also, there was a 10 issue 60s Spectre series, which has never been reprinted. And it's got fantastic art by Neil Adams and Nick Cardy and Jim Aparo, and really good stuff in there. As well as some other Spectre-related stuff leading right up to the Spectre series that launched in 87. Those types of things I'm interested in. Marvel, I buy the Epic collections, so I just like revisiting the older books that way.
Yeah, I love those books. They're great.
And I know they have the X-Men Proteus Saga one is coming out in September, I think.
Yeah.
And that's a good run.
Yeah, it's great.
Not that I can read it in Masterworks or whatever right now, but I like the Epic collections for whatever reason.
Yeah, there's something about them that's just the right amount of comics in that 500 pages, and you feel like you get a good bang for your buck.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I ended up having I used to get the Marvel Masterworks. I have a full set up to a certain point, and then now that they're into the 80s stuff, I'm like. I don't want to pay $100 for a hardcover of Dazzler.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's just not...
That's the point, right? That's the breaking point, the Dazzler. $100.
Yeah. I drew the line. And I started to say, you know what? The Fantastic Four material, I already have the John Byrne omnibuses. I don't need to buy Marvel Masterworks of John Byrne FF again.
Right.
Just to have a full run. And Amazing Spider-Man, now we're into the, the John Romita Jr. stuff. And I'm trying to remember who the writer was, and I'm completely blacking on it.
Which run?
So around Spidey 240.
Oh, Roger Stern. Yeah.
That's
good stuff. That's really good stuff.
That is really good stuff. Yeah, and I have the Roger Stern omnibus. So I'm like, what do I want to pay $100 for half of that when I've already got $100 omnibus? So.
Right. It's true. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, I think we could wrap up there, Kev. This has been fun.
All right. This has been a long, rambling narrative.
No, yeah. It's good. I like the information. I love understanding the inside workings of the comic book world as well, because it does inform you on what it is you're buying, where you're buying from, how to get the most value for your money. And, we're collectors, so we care about these things. So I enjoy it. I always enjoy the chats. I hope you stay safe, you stay healthy.
You too.
And that we get to see each other soon at some shows or at a comic book shop. That'd be nice.
Yeah, hopefully soon. If not, feel free to give me a call.
Yeah, we could do this. We could do our favorite Superman stories. I think you'd be a good guy to talk to about Superman, seeing that you read so much about it.
Yep.
All right.
Well, pretty soon I'll have the Schuster Award nominations ready to put out, so maybe we can talk about that.
Yeah, that'd be good. When is that going to happen?
I'm hoping sometime in July that I'll have all the nominations picked from the committees and so forth. I've been getting the lists together, so
okay.
And then hopefully I'll be able to move forward with some announcements, and then we'll announce the winners in probably late August, early September.
Sounds good. It's a plan. Mm-hmm. All right.
All right. Sounds good. Care.
Everybody, thanks, go Eric. To your comic book shop and support your shop, okay?
Exactly. They need the business right now. So go and find a trade paperback there of something you've never seen before, and you might find your next favorite book.
That's so. Right. That's right. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Kev. And we will talk soon.
Sounds good.